welcome to this episode of the Sleep Health Podcast. This is on the Restonic Power of Sleep channel, and I'm Dr. Bentley, talking about non-CPAP options for treating obstructive sleep apnea. Now, many people, when they think about obstructive sleep apnea, and let's remind ourselves what that is somebody who snores a lot, whose airway collapses during the night, and they need to be woken up to restart the airflow. That's that, so that air is moving again. Most people, when they think of sleep apnea, think of CPAP, which is the machine, as we mentioned, a reverse vacuum cleaner, which blows air down the nose, little machine with a pipe, blows air through a mask down into that part of your throat that's collapsing and holds it open so that you can breathe properly. Now, most people equate having sleep apnea with having to have a CPAP machine and that being the only option that you have for treatment. And in fact, many people don't even go and get diagnosed with sleep apnea because they're so scared that they're going to have to use that machine. They don't know anything about the machine, but they're just scared of it. And so they don't even get diagnosed. And that's really sad because they live with poor quality sleep for ages just because they're scared of one of the treatments. Now, there's no question that if your sleep apnea is severe enough, and by that we mean more than moderate, so moderate would be 15 to 30 apneas per hour. So over 20 apneas per hour is usually the line that we use to say if it's more than 20 apneas per hour, everybody internationally would recommend nasal CPAP. So that's, again, the machine blowing air down your nose to open it up. And that's because over that line, that is where all the research that we have tells us that you're in danger of something else happening, of another disorder. So apart from the symptoms that you might have from that daily, that is waking up tired, because if you think about it, having been woken up 20 times per hour during the night, sleeping 8 hours, that's kind of 160 times you got woken up, you're going to wake up tired. You're going to be sleepy during the day. That's the major symptom we have of sleep apnea. So apart from that, what we now know with really good evidence, again, over 20, so that's where most of the studies look at, is that if it's in that area, you're more likely to get heart disease, diabetes, dementia, depression, liver disease, in fact, anything, because at that level, you now start underservicing the car, that is the body, underservicing the car, and it breaks down faster. So the data we have is that all of those big diseases that we're heading for at some point in our lives are all going to happen about 10 years earlier. And so we get ill earlier, we have medical disorders earlier, and we live with a medical disorder for longer. And so that's never good, because that's always there's a limit to how long you can live with a medical disorder, and so it tends to shorten your lifespan. So because of that, and we don't want that to happen, because of that, we'll always recommend CPAP at that level so that we can push those disorders back. CPAP is very useful because we can monitor that you are being treated. Every CPAP machine has a smart card in it. We can tell that your apneas are under control. We can tell how long you've slept for. And we can, in that way, say that you are then safe from those disorders happening. And so that's why many people would recommend CPAP over 20 per hour. But unfortunately, a lot of people think that CPAP is the only option that we have for treatment, and that is just not true. There are many other options. There are many patients who cannot tolerate CPAP. There are also a lot of patients who ask me, if I go on CPAP, am I going to be dependent on it, i.e. I can never get off it? Or is there a chance that I can come off CPAP, i.e. it's a temporary thing? And there is evidence that in some patients it's a temporary thing. And as we go through the other options for treatment, you'll maybe understand that if you can go on CPAP, do these other options, manage the causes of sleep apnea behind the scenes, and then there may be a situation where you can come off the CPAP and now you don't have apnea anymore. There's also a chance, and we've seen it in a number of patients, that if you go on CPAP, there is a restoration of the muscle tone that occurs in the throat. So over a period of time, that things seem to sort themselves out. You don't have as much swelling in the back of the throat because it's all settled down. And then it's much easier to come off CPAP after 3 to 6 months or so. So there are a number of patients who can come off CPAP. But you may have to do something else apart from just the CPAP. And those are the options that I'm going to talk about today. What else can you do if CPAP either doesn't work, you cannot tolerate it, or you have numbers that are less than 20 per hour? Because less than 20 per hour, you may have symptoms, but you're not necessarily have an increased risk of all of those other disorders. And so we have other options to treat. So the options that I'm going to talk about today are those for which we have evidence. There's lots of stuff. I mean, if you go on the internet and you go treating sleep apnea, what are my options? You're going to get adverts coming at you from all sides for all kinds of devices, all kinds of stuff, all kinds of things that people will say work, but they don't have actual evidence. And when we talk about evidence, we talk about proper research studies that are done against what we call placebo or control subjects where they haven't been treated, where these options have been proven to have a reduction in apnea. Those are the only options I'm looking at today, because as doctors, we're expected to practice evidence-based medicine, and this is the evidence that we have. There's more and more evidence coming out, and certainly within a year or two, this podcast might be a bit dated because there may be new things that are coming out. But this is the state of play currently, and I'm talking about things or appliances or situations which are really occurring that we have available to us in South Africa. There are other options internationally. So things like hypoglossal nerve stimulation, where they insert like a little pacemaker into your shoulder with a device that monitors the muscles in between the ribs to see when they're breathing out and sends an impulse to the back of the tongue to pull it forward. It sounds quite gross, but it works really well. It's really expensive and nobody in South Africa does it. So I'm not going to talk any more about that, but there's lots of other things like that, which have been looked at, which do have evidence to say that they do work, but we just don't have them available here in South Africa. So I'm not spending time on them, just to mention that you will find these other things. So there are seven different treatments for sleep apnea apart from CPAP, seven different things that have been proven to have an effect. I'm going to talk about each one of them, and I'm going to remind you where we are in that process as we go through all seven. Now, what's interesting about the seven options that we have and how medicine works, really, and how medical research works is So the first one is called positional therapy. If you're going to prove that positional therapy works, you have to say, if we do positional therapy on this group of people compared to that group where we don't do positional therapy, does it work? Okay, that's how you do the research. So each of these seven options has been tested like that and has been shown to have an effect in dropping apnea, but not in 100% of people. And not 100% of the apnea. So often what will happen is that the literature will say, because positional therapy only works in 40% of patients, CPAP is a better option because we know it works in 100% of people. And so there's, in my kind of attitude is I'm going, who are those 30%? Let's find those 30% and treat them with positional therapy. Then they don't need CPAP. So each of these options works in some people, doesn't work in everybody, and it's difficult to know who these options are going to work in. So often we try all of these options, in fact, we try them and say, which do we think is the one that's most likely to work? Or, as what happens in many people, is do we need to have multiple options that we go for rather than just one? It's very unlikely that there is one cause of sleep apnea in an individual. It's likely that there are multiple causes. And if we only focus on one cause, we're likely to fail a number of our patients in that it's not going to work in everybody. So the research that hasn't been done is that even if we have severe apnea, what happens if we use multiple combinations of these seven options? So if we put a whole bunch together, use three or four options, can we get a better effect? That's the research that hasn't been done. So I cannot give you data on that. But it makes sense that if you have a patient who has a number of different causes, that tackling all of those causes is likely to get you a better result than just tackling one. And where this becomes a problem is for patients is that if you go to a dentist, for example, they will generally only tell you about the dental devices and the mandibular advancement devices, which do work, but it's only one option. If you go to an endocrinologist, they're likely to only tell you about weight loss. If you go to an ear, nose, and throat surgeon, they will generally tell you about the options that they have. And what patients need is all the options, and ethically they are entitled to know all the options that are available to them, including CPAP, so that patients can make an informed choice and that patients can decide which route they want to take. There are patients who, and I have seen patients who have been told they need to go on CPAP, cannot afford it, and they kind of think, well, there's nothing else I can do then, I just have to live with this. And their answer is no, you don't. There are other options. You should try all of those other options because you may be lucky. You may have one of these situations where if you combine three or four of these options, that it may resolve the apnea, at least down to a level at which the symptoms are gone. You can carry on with work, and you can drive. Remember that the major symptom of sleep apnea is daytime sleepiness. And if you're in a situation where you are driving and falling asleep, that's dangerous. And even if we can pull the apneas back by 50% so that you are not as sleepy during the day, that is a win. So all of these non-CPAP options, I'm going to go through individually. But remember that you can combine them. For each of these options, I'm going to start with how do we focus on this area the easiest way we can and the cheapest way we can to see if it is likely to work. Because what we don't want to do is spend thousands of rands on each option only to find that the last one is the one that works. So we want to be able to assess them. So how do you know it's working? If you do try one of these options, how do you know it's working? Well, one of the ways is the daytime sleepiness, that you wake up feeling better in the morning. The other way is to get an app which records snoring, because if the snoring is being reduced, then it's likely that the apnea is being reduced. So get an app that monitors snoring, try something, does it make a difference to the snoring? So there are a number of apps. The app that I tend to use is called SnoreLab. Which gives you really good recordings of your snoring and as well as severity of the snoring that you can monitor every night, as to what's happening. So you can try something and go, did it affect the snoring, etc. Remembering that snoring is not enough. You can't just reduce the snoring. But in this scenario, what you would do is try various things to see if it affects the snoring. Get to a point where you go, I've tried everything possible. Then have another sleep study to check the apneas to see how much resolution you've had of the apneas. It's really important that all of these other options, you have to have a repeat study to check that they have worked. And many patients, for example, the mandibular devices are put on a device without a sleep study to see if they have apnea in the first place and never done a repeat study to prove that the apnea has been treated. And that is not adequate medicine. I mean, you need to know that the apnea is being treated. Even if it's mild apnea, if the apnea isn't treated, it is likely to get worse over time. So really important, if you think you have apnea, to have a proper assessment, i.e. a home study for apnea to check what the numbers are, to know what the numbers are. Are they higher than 20? Do I need to be on CPAP? If not, what are my options? And then to have a repeat study to make sure that the apnea is being treated. Okay, so that's the lead-in to the seven options that we have. So option number one, positional therapy. So I'm going to go through all seven options. I'm going to read all seven, and then I'm going to go through each individually. So number one, positional therapy. Number two, jaw position control or mandibular advancement. So that's aiming at the jaw. Surgical options, so that's ENT surgery generally, so the ear, nose, and throat surgeons. Gastric reflux, weight loss, improving muscle tone, and then medications or pharmaceutical therapy that we have for sleep apnea. And though that's drugs, and people would go like, how on earth would drugs help with sleep apnea? Well, they do. We're not quite sure, but we think it's got something to do with muscle tone. So let's start with number one, positional therapy. Every single home study test that you do can give you how bad the apnea is in different body positions. And that is generally supine. So supine is when you're lying on your back. Prone is when you're lying on your tummy. And then obviously left or right. And so it should give you, and you should have as part of the report, how bad it is in the different body positions. Now, the main body position we're interested in is supine. That is lying on your back. And that's because when you lie on your back, as opposed to the other body positions, your jaw tends to move backwards just under gravity, because all the muscles have relaxed around the jaw. The jaw tends to move back and is more likely to cause obstruction when you lie on your back compared to any other position. Now, we know that about 60% of patients who have apnea have a positional component. That means it is worse when they lie on their back. Now, that doesn't mean that if you don't lie on your back, it's sorted, but it may mean that it reduces it. So you have different grades of positional apnea. So you do have patients who might have an apnea index overall for the night of 20 per hour. And when they lie on their back, it's 50 per hour. And it's relatively easy to do the maths then to kind of go, if they didn't lie on their back, what would the apneas be? And it might be 5. Now, 5 is normal. And so that would be a major win if we could find those patients who, when we kept them off their back, would not have any apnea whatsoever. But even in patients where it would only drop from 20 to 15, that's a win, because maybe then we can use one of the other 6 options to move it from 15 to 10 and then 10 to 5. So any drop in apneas with body position is a potential treatment option. So then, and many people say to me, oh, I don't sleep on my back. I only sleep on my left or my right side. Well, unfortunately, you don't know what happens when you sleep. So, and I always say to patients, so how do you get from your left side to your right side without actually being on your back for at least 5 seconds? Remembering that you lying on your back is a very stable position for the body. I mean, you're flat, you're not moving anywhere, brain can just relax. And so everyone tends to sleep on their back at least for a little while. Okay. And so that's the reason for the home study, is to see how much time you spend on your back. Because if it's an hour and you have lots of apnea in that hour, that's obviously something that we can target for treatment. So how do we keep people off their back? Well, the simplest way to do it is what's called the tennis ball technique. Yes, there is research on the tennis ball technique. And the tennis ball technique is simply taking whatever you wear at night. And so it needs to be relatively close fitting. So like a t-shirt, not a very loose kind of pajama top. And in the middle of your back, between your shoulder blades, is sew a pocket on there. And into that pocket, previously used a tennis ball, I think that's too big, so either a golf ball or a squash ball into that little pocket. You can also use a practice golf ball, so the one with big holes in them, and sew that directly onto your pajamas or your t-shirt in between your shoulder blades. What that means is that at night, when you go from your right-hand side and move over onto your back, because it is uncomfortable, it's essentially the princess and the pea principle, that it's uncomfortable, you can't lie on your back because you're lying on a bit of a mountain, that you will continue moving and lie onto your left-hand side. So it sounds really uncomfortable, but the data tells us that your sleep is not disrupted, that you sleep just as well, that you sleep just as long, that the apneas drop, because based on what we have on the data from the sleep study, your apneas will drop, and that there is a training effect that occurs over a week or so, that you learn not to sleep on your back. You can then often take that ball away and not sleep on your back for a while. Generally, your bed partner will tell you if you're sleeping on your back again, and you just put it back for a little while. So that is the easiest way, and it's certainly the cheapest way to prove the principle. Remember, we said what we want to know is, does this work at all? So using the golf ball, squash ball in the little pocket at the back, or sewed on directly, will help us stay off our back, and we can measure that. We can look at the snoring and go, right, does that make a big difference? There are also pillows you can use to stay off your back. So there's pillows that you can put behind your back. So essentially, you can stay off your back if you take a pool noodle and stick it inside your t-shirt and you're lying on it if you lie on your back. That'll work as well. But you can buy pillows that are designed to put behind your back, relatively hard pillows, so that you can't roll over onto your back. The problem that they tend to have is that if you have them on your right side, you can't move anywhere. You're kind of stuck on your left-hand side. And if you want to lie on your right-hand side, it's a lot harder to do that. But there are also pillows that you can get for your head. And they essentially are constructed of two sides that you can lie on. So you can either lie on your left-hand side or your right-hand side. If you try to lie on your back, you either slip off the pillow or you try to sleep on the mountain, and that's more uncomfortable. And so by positioning the head on the left or the right-hand side, you can make the positional therapy work. So there's the tennis ball technique, and there are the pillows. And then you can also spend quite a bit of money on a band that fits around your chest, which monitors when you're lying on your back and vibrates to your chest, and so wakes you up to move. And there are quite a lot of what are called vibratory devices, which generally have a little box or something on the side of the neck or on the front or the back of the neck, which if you're on your back vibrates. So if you lie on your back and there's pressure on this device, then it vibrates so that you move off your back. So there's a whole range of things that are designed to keep you off your back. So try them, see if it, get the data from your sleep study, see if there's a positional component to your apnea. If there is, then these are fairly simple things that you can do at home. You don't need a doctor to help you with this, to see if that will make a difference to the snoring and the apnea. And please remember that even if it's just snoring that's a problem, all of these seven mechanisms work for snoring as well. So it's not just about patients who have apnea. If you have no apnea, but you have significant snoring, then all of these can be looked at as well. Right, so that's positional therapy. The second one is jaw position control. Now, as we mentioned, your jaw is a very heavy bone. All the muscles that hold it in place relax when you're asleep, and so it is more mobile and it can move. Now, there may be some indications that your jaw is a part of the apnea, and that is people wake up with sore muscles. You grind your teeth at night, or you clench your teeth at night, and that grinding and clenching your teeth it's not the only reason, but one of the reasons is that your jaw is moving at night, and your brain is trying to stabilize it by grinding, by clenching your teeth together. So that may be an indication that you have sleep apnea, in fact. And so that may indicate that the jaw is a problem for you and you may need to target that particular mechanism. Now, keeping the jaw in place, there's many things that you can do to keep the jaw in place. As I mentioned, we will always go with the cheapest thing, see if that works as a concept, and then go, what can we do now for long term? So the cheapest way to keep your jaw in place is mouth taping. That basically means you'll go and get some Micropore from your local pharmacy, and you will tape across your mouth to hold your mouth closed, and that keeps your jaw in place. It's not perfect, but it does give you an indication, is this something that I can do? The main indication often in people is when they tape their mouth closed, they go, I can't breathe through my nose. So I can't tape my mouth. I can't breathe through my nose. Well, that gives us information as well. Maybe you need to go see an ear, nose, and throat surgeon because there's something in your nose that's the problem. But we'll deal with that in a little while. So mouth taping is the easiest way to do it. Just to check, is it a concept at all? Now, I kind of poo-pooed mouth taping because I went, meh, you know, really, what could it actually do? Until I had a young patient who had 20 apneas per hour, which is CPAP territory. And I said, look, theoretically, you have to go on CPAP. And he said to me, look, I've been trying mouth taping because I saw it on TikTok. I've been trying mouth taping and I think it works. Can I do another study with mouth taping? And I said, of course you can. Well, his apneas dropped to 12, out of the danger zone now. And I'm kind of going, well, clearly it works in some people. Do we know who it works in? And can I tell you if you particularly, if it's going to work in you? No. And so that's why you need to try it. So mouth taping is the first of the jaw control mechanisms. Then it goes to chin strap. Now, you can get a chin strap for $150 on the internet. And all it does is gently, it's not important to like squash your jaw or hold it in place with a lot of tension. The drop in the jaw, the opening of the mouth that happens with sleep is a very passive process because of gravity, because of this heavy bone. So you just need to gently hold it in place. So you can get a chin strap and it just goes over your head and under your chin and holds your jaw in place. That's another thing to try. Same concept, jaw control. Then you can go into the mandibular devices, and they range from cheap ones that you can get on the internet, you can get from your local pharmacy. what we call boil and bite. And so you put them in hot water, you put it in your mouth, you bite on them, takes the shape of your teeth, and then you wear that at night. And what they're designed to do is to hold your jaw in place so that your jaw doesn't go back. If you put something in your mouth, your jaw tends to hold it there. And so the bottom jaw kind of holds it. Now, generally, the boil and bite ones are simply just holding it in place. The other mechanism is what we call mandibular advancement, and that is to pull the bottom jaw forward relative to the top jaw. And what that is doing is opening the space behind the jaw, opening the throat so that there is more space to breathe. Now, there's good evidence that the mandibular advancement devices, when they are made for you and they fit properly, do have an impact on apnea. But they don't work in everybody. So we do have evidence that they work in about 50% of people and that they'll drop the apneas by about 50%. So they do work, they do drop the apneas, but you can understand if you drop the apneas by 50% on average, so some people it'll be more, some people it'll be less, you haven't solved the problem, you've only dropped it by half. There's still something else that you need to do. So the mandibular devices, so the ones that actually pull the jaw forward, there are cheap ones that you can get on the internet. Please make sure if you get one from the internet that it can be adjusted, what we call titrated. So it has those kind of words. It's adjustable. It's titratable, that you can get one like that because it means you can move it forwards or backwards. Or you can get one from a dentist, and the dentist will make a top retainer and a bottom retainer and then use some mechanism to hold the two together and to relatively push the bottom jaw forward against the top jaw. Now, it works. They work well, as I've mentioned. They do work well. It is really important that you have another study afterwards to make sure it is working, because there are a bunch of people it doesn't work at all in, because the jaw is not their problem. So it is important to get the study, and it's also important to understand that there are consequences to using one of these devices. One of the main consequences is that because there's a tension between the front, the bottom teeth and the top teeth, is that they tend to move teeth. And so just as when you have orthodontics, there's a tension on the teeth and the tension is deliberate in order to move the teeth into the right place. Most devices, one of the big consequences is that they can move teeth. So you do need to monitor your bite. You need to make sure that your bite is okay and that the teeth are not moving. I have unfortunately seen a number of patients who have used a device for 7 to 10 years, and their teeth have moved so much that they now need really expensive orthodontic treatment, braces, to move their teeth back into a position where they can even chew properly. So I have patients who can't chew because they have used these devices. So it's really important to monitor your bite. You should get a correcting device with the device that you use at night. The correcting devices you use in the morning to get your bite back into place. So the idea is that it may move teeth at night, but you can pull it back in the morning. And so there is this movement constantly happening. So they do work. They are useful. Please make sure that you monitor your teeth, that you do regular checkups either with the dentist who gave you the device or another dentist to check that your bite is not changing in any way that is abnormal and that is going to lead to other complications or more expense later on. So just a proviso on those devices, important to go for checkups. Patients tend not to, and we tend not to follow up patients unless they come to us. So please make sure that every 6 months you go back, check the bite, check that it's working, check that there's no problem with the device. So that's the jaw position control. The very last section of the jaw position control is if there is fundamentally an anatomical problem with the jaw. And we get this in a lot of people. So the jaw is relatively back compared to the top jaw, or it's much smaller than the top jaw. Is the maxillofacial surgeons do surgery on the jaw to move the entire top and bottom jaw forward. I think it's quite a big op. The maxillofacial surgeons don't think it's a big op. I guess they have bigger ops to do. So it's quite a big op. It is expensive to do, but it is a cure in that everything that I've spoken about up to now in the jaw control area is a treatment, has to be done every night. this is the only way to solve a jaw recession problem or a shorter jaw is to do surgery to pull it forward. And then that generally solves the problem. So it can be done. It is the last in the line, and it's most patients would go, let me try everything else before I have to go for that kind of surgery. So that's the jaw control. So we've done positional therapy, tennis ball technique. We've done jaw position control, all kinds of different things that you can do for that. Then we look at ENT, so the ear, nose, and throat surgeons. There's no question that if you have a fixed obstruction in the nose or the throat, that that can cause apnea. But it's not the only thing, and it's certainly not so significant that it is a definite that every person has that, because they don't. A kind of a blockage in the nose is definitely going to increase snoring, because you are moving the air faster. You're having to suck harder to get past an obstruction. But many people don't have any obstruction in the, you know, the nose and the throat, which could cause apnea. But certainly if you're in a situation where you go, my left nostril is relatively blocked compared to the right. And no matter how much I blow my nose, I cannot blow that obstruction out. There's something there. Then you need to see an ear, nose, and throat surgeon. They are the people who will do an endoscopy, and that is put a little camera down your nose, have a look down there to see, is there anything that is actually causing that obstruction? So that obstruction can range from a deviated septum. So if you've ever broken your nose, if you kind of feel like the one side is smaller than the other side or narrower when it comes to airflow, deviated septum, tonsils and adenoids. We know that children who snore and have apnea, and by the way, snoring is never normal in children. Children who have snoring and apnea, if you take out their tonsils and adenoids, 95% cure that they don't snore or have apnea anymore. And it's really important to do that, because they may develop apnea later on in life. So tonsils and adenoids may be the problem. There may be a polyp that you have developed in the nose because of chronic allergic rhinitis, for example. So there are many kind of things that could cause apnea or could cause snoring that the ear, nose, and throat surgeon would be able to have a look for. In Johannesburg, the major reason, major nose kind of problem that we have is the fact that our noses are not designed to live in Johannesburg. We are too high, we are too dry, we are too polluted, and we're too cold in winter. And the nose is extraordinarily good at humidifying and warming air and cleaning the air, but it takes a toll on the nose. And you can get a chronic inflammation in the nose where the lining of the nose is swollen. And because it's inside bone, the swelling can only come inside. And so your nose is relatively narrowed. And often, the ear, nose, and throat surgeons will say you need to have a steroid spray for your nose just to open it up to manage that inflammation. And that can honestly reduce snoring and can reduce some apnea, just by doing that, by just using a steroid spray. Now, everybody panics a bit when we talk about steroids. The steroid sprays for the nose, the steroid is put exactly in the place where it's meant to be. And they have really good evidence to show that it does not go into the system, the whole body. And so your body is not exposed to steroids, which obviously is not a good idea long term. These steroid sprays are limited to the nose. It kind of settles there, does its job, and is done. So you can use steroid sprays long term. So the steroid sprays you can get over the counter if you go to the pharmacist and ask for a steroid spray. I would definitely take doctor's advice on it. So I wouldn't just go and get a steroid spray. Go to your GP and say, please, could you have a look in my nose? Does it look inflamed? Would a steroid spray likely to work for me? So that somebody is actually monitoring that whole system. The ENTs can also do quite extensive surgery to manage apneas. So there's a surgical technique which moves muscles in the back of the throat. I think it looks like quite a big surgery, but again, I'm a bit of a wuss when it comes to surgery. It does have evidence that it works. There are a few ENTs in the country who do that surgery. And again, if you're looking for a cure for sleep apnea, then surgery is often your only option. I would always recommend patients that check that that is the option and that is going to work. And that is by excluding that the other things are components of the cause of your apnea. Because again, if you focus on that And actually, there are other components which might be causing apnea. You're likely not to get a perfect solution afterwards. And we would always like the best option, and that is you will have restoration or reduction of the apneas down to normal if you're going to go through an extensive surgical procedure. So an ENT assessment is always good to see if there is a blockage. Remember that having an ENT or an ear, nose and throat surgeon appointment to have a look at the blockage does not obligate you to have surgery at all, but it does again point you to options that you have as far as managing the apnea is concerned. Okay, so we've done positional therapy, we've done jaw control, and we've done surgical options or the ear, nose and throat surgeon. Then there's gastric reflux. Now, people would say, what on earth does reflux or heartburn have to do with apnea? Well, if you do have reflux fairly often, and particularly if you have it at night, it is then very, very much linked to sleep apnea. So if you wake up with reflux or that bitter taste or that metallic taste in your mouth, or you're coughing at night, then it may be that you have reflux. During the day, the acid is kept in your stomach by gravity because you're upright. But when you lie down at night, there's no gravity protecting it. And if the sphincter that you have, the little muscular band that sits between the esophagus and the stomach, is not great, then the acid can leak up the esophagus and get into the back of your throat just because you're lying flat. And so when it gets to the back of the throat, obviously none of that lining right up from the stomach, right the way to the back of the throat, is designed to have acid on it. And so if it has acid, it's going to swell, and there's your obstruction. So you have a swelling towards the base of the tongue, and then you have an obstruction. So that's how it causes obstruction. But also, if you have apnea at night, you're likely to have reflux. So reflux can cause apnea, but apnea can cause reflux as well. And it's always difficult to know which way around this goes. So when you have apnea, you close off the throat, your chest continues to breathe. And remember, apnea is never about that you stop breathing at night. It's that you stop moving air. So the chest continues to try and expand. And what that's doing is creating negative pressures in the chest. If it's not moving air from up from the throat down, it can pull acid from the stomach up. And so the apnea itself, the mechanism of apnea, can produce reflux and heartburn at night. So very importantly, it's a chicken and egg story. We often don't know which way around it goes. But you can do anti-reflux therapy to see if the reflux you're having at night is a cause of the apnea or if it's from the apnea itself. So anti-reflux therapy is really easy. You've got to move dinner away from going to bed by at least 3 hours. So that is, if bedtime is at 10, dinner has to be at 7 or before. So you have to have 3 hours where you are upright, allowing the digestion to happen, allowing the stomach to clear before you go to bed. Right? So that's number one, big part of it. Number two is to try take something like Gaviscon or some other anti-reflux treatment that you can get over the counter before you go to bed. So it's just taking a tablespoon of Gaviscon before you go to bed, separating dinner and going to bed, and let's see what happens. Okay. Again, monitor the snoring with a snoring app. See if the snoring goes down. We've had astonishing results from just doing this very simple thing. Now, the warning is you cannot continue to take Gaviscon every night. If you have reflux at night, you do need to go and tell your doctor that I have reflux at night. Please, can I be on a treatment that is more long-term than Gaviscon every night? So Gaviscon is not a long-term therapy. All we're trying to do here is prove the point again. So again, each of these types of treatments that we have for sleep apnea, we have how do we prove the point cheaply and easily, and then what is the long-term management? And the long-term management may be different to our cheap and easy kind of prove the point solution. So the Gaviscon is the cheap and easy prove the point. And then we go and we say, right, clearly I do have reflux and I need treatment for that, because it is not okay that you have acid going up your esophagus all night long. That causes complications for the esophagus and potentially cancerous change in the cells of the esophagus. So it's not something to be just ignore. It is something that you need to treat. So if that works for you, then please go and see your doctor about a long-term treatment for the reflux. So we've had positional therapy, we've had jaw position control, we've had ear, nose, and throat surgeon, and we've had gastric reflux. Number five is weight loss. There is no question that most patients who have apnea have put on weight, and that's why they have apnea. What putting on weight does, particularly in men, is because men put on weight around the neck and the chest area, it narrows the weight gain around that area, narrows throat. And so whatever collapsibility you have within the throat is made worse because the throat is narrower. I have seen CAT scans of the neck of patients who are severely overweight, and there is literally no airway there. You cannot see a nice big black hole in the middle of the throat, which is where the airway is supposed to be. So weight gain, and it's problematic. The weight gain is problematic because often patients get apnea because of some other reason. We've got multiple reasons why you could have apnea that we've mentioned. Get sleep apnea, feel tired during the day, and then put on weight. So the weight gain causes apnea, but apnea can also cause weight gain for a number of reasons. So weight gain occurs because you're tired, and so you do less physical activity during the day. And we're not just talking about the hour in the gym. We're talking about the 10,000 steps, that you just don't move as much during the day. And worse, you calorie hunt because you're exhausted, and so you're hunting for energy. And that hunting for energy never comes in the form of salads. It always comes in the form of carbohydrates or fats. So people who are tired, if they're going hunting for food, they hunt for chips and biscuits and cake and sandwiches and things like that. They never hunt for salads. So you tend to take more calories in. You tend to burn less calories, and that's never a good combination. So you're always going to put on weight gradually. So the fatigue of the sleep apnea makes you tend to put on weight. But worse than that, if you have significant apnea, and so what significant is, I'm not really sure. So what the number is, I'm not really sure, because it's different for different people. But if you have significant apnea, remembering that what the one of the consequences of that apnea is you get woken up. And when you get woken up, there's a little adrenaline surge that happens. So it pushes up your blood pressure, pushes up your pulse rate, but metabolically puts your body into a state of emergency. So like, what is happening? Something's happening. Let's prepare for that. Okay. And preparing for an emergency means you store food because you might need it. Okay. But you also push glucose out in the system, and you push lipids out in the system, so you have food available to use. So I used to give lectures on metabolism to the second years, and I would always say you need to consider that glucose is cash for the body. So it pushes out glucose so that there's cash to use in an emergency. But that emergency is happening 100 times a night with no real emergency. So you can understand that over a period of time, the entire metabolic system is changed. And so your body is managing food differently to what it used to do. There's an entire paper written on how the fat cell changes in just if you drop oxygen, which is another consequence of apnea. So how the fat cell is now working not the way that you think it is. Now, when you try to lose weight with diet and exercise, the diet and exercise is aimed at a fat cell that is working in a certain way. So if you diet and exercise, you will be able to reduce the amount of fat that's sitting in that cell. But when you have sleep apnea, it's entirely possible that the fat cell is working in a completely different way to what you expect. So we have good data that if you have sleep apnea, the diet and exercise, they use a very elegant expression, has attenuated results. And that means it doesn't have the results that you expect. And I see many patients who go, I have been on a diet, I have exercised, and I've lost 3 kilos out of 30 and nothing more. It's just stuck at 3 kilos. And it may entirely be that it's because you have apnea that it is difficult for you to lose weight. Because, again, we have data that patients who are overweight who go on CPAP, i.e. you reverse all the apnea, that then diet and exercise works. Because you have reversed those metabolic changes, you've turned the fat cell into being a fat cell that we know how it's working now, and so the diet and exercise works. So if you treat the apnea, it is easier to lose weight. Weight loss is never easy, but it is easier to lose weight if you treat the apnea. Also, if you use CPAP, and this is where we use CPAP as a temporary measure, if you use CPAP, you wake up in the morning feeling refreshed. So it's easier to go to the gym. It is easier to control your eating. And so that helps as well. So generally, in patients who need to have a significant weight loss, we would often say to them, please go on CPAP because it'll be easier to lose weight. Once you've lost weight, take you off the CPAP, redo the apnea test, and you may find that you don't have apnea anymore. So again, this is a potential cure for apnea, is to lose weight. But it is tricky. It is harder to lose weight if you have apnea. Now, the important thing now is we now have medications to help you lose weight. So what they're called the GLP-1 inhibitors, and those are things like Ozempic and Saxenda, injections that you have to lose weight. And we have good evidence that they do help you lose weight. And we now have at least two studies that show that if you do lose the weight, that the number of apneas go down. This is not a new finding. We know that if you lose weight, that the apneas go down. What we have is a way through these medications is to make it easier for you to lose weight. Now, how much weight do you need to lose to impact on the apnea? Again, is a tricky thing to know, because it's difficult to know how much weight you're going to lose from the significant parts of the airway. And that is the tongue, because you do store fat in the tongue. It sounds a bit gross, but that's what you do. And you store fat around the neck. So it is difficult to know how much fat is going to move from that particular area. And so how much importance we're going, how much impact we're going to have on the sleep apnea. But kind of the numbers that are thrown about is that you need to lose at least 10 kilos or at least 10% of your body mass. Or it's most likely to help if you, the worse the apnea is at baseline. So if you have severe apnea, then losing weight is likely to have more of an impact. But there are lots of patients who will say to me, men patients who will say to me, I know that my weight is important because if I weigh 78 kilograms, I don't snore. If I weigh 80 kilograms, I snore. So sometimes it's a very fine line between snoring and not snoring and apnea that people know if they can lose weight, that they can reduce the level of apneas. So weight loss definitely is important, and we would do everything possible to help you lose weight, even if that's putting you on CPAP for 3 to 6 months, getting the weight loss to happen, and then being able to take you off the CPAP. So a really important part of this alternative therapy to CPAP. So we have positional therapy, we have jaw, we have surgical, we have gastric reflux, we have weight loss, and then we have increasing pharyngeal muscle tone. Part of the reason we think that apnea gets worse as you get older, particularly as you go over the age of 50, is that the muscle tone in the throat gets weaker. These are not muscles that we usually exercise deliberately, and so the muscle tone gets weaker, and that weak muscle tone is what causes an increase in collapsibility, i.e. it's more likely to collapse if you have other things going on. And there are now some studies that have shown that if you do some speech therapy exercises, deliberately looking at the muscle tone in the throat, that can reduce the apneas. They're fairly easy exercises. There's not a clear list of exercises that these are the ones that have been shown, but they're generally exercises on the tongue. And they would be things like taking your tongue and pressing it up against the palate a number of times, sticking your tongue out and back and out and back, pushing your tongue from side to side, saying things, making noises that would actually improve the muscle tone. So there are studies that show that these exercises do work. There are also studies, for example, that show that if you exercise those muscles by playing a wind instrument, that also improves muscle tone. So the very first one that came out, which is really a long time ago, 30 or so years ago, because CPAP was invented in Australia and Australia have done a lot of work on sleep apnea, there was an article that showed if you played the didgeridoo, which those of you who don't know is a long wooden tube that if you play and makes that whoa, whoa, whoa kind of noise, that if you play the didgeridoo, that can improve apnea. So that was followed by a number of studies that showed if you played a wind instrument, that also improved. So any wind instrument, you didn't have to have a didgeridoo, any wind instrument. The final kind of study on that looked at which wind instrument is the best one to play for sleep apnea. It looked at a whole range of wind instruments. So obviously wind instruments range from didgeridoos and vuvuzelas to trumpets to trombones to clarinets to all kinds of different kind of wind instruments. And those of you who want to know, the best wind instrument to play is those with the double reed. Apparently those are the ones that work the best in managing sleep apnea. And the idea really is, if you look at the basics behind the wind instrument, most wind instruments, in order to play them, you don't blow, but you create a kind of noise. And if you just do that, you can feel the muscles in your throat tightening. And so that is what the thing is. It's about creating that noise. And so you can just, you don't have to have a wind instrument. You don't have to go out and buy a trumpet. If you just do that exercise of creating that noise, you can feel the muscles in your throat tightening up. So that is one of the exercises included in the list. So if you need a list of the exercises, Aero Healthcare website does have all of these options in paper format that you can download as a PDF document. The Restonic Essentia Sleep Clinic, I'll put the same document up on that clinic, so on that website, so that you can go and download it, so that you have all of this information. So a group of those exercises I have put in that document. There are obviously a lot more that other people have suggested. We don't have a good list. We don't have a list that I can say these are the exercises that have been shown to have an effect. But it is an option. So it is an option to use. The last option is the medical or the drug kind of therapies for apnea. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning, you would kind of go, how on earth could drugs work? Well, we presume they're working on the muscle tone, tightening up the muscles in that area of the throat, because they literally can't do anything else. So what are the drugs? So some of the studies have shown, just like the jaw devices, that they can drop the apneas down by 50%. But again, those studies don't say these are the patients, these kind of characteristics of patients, these are the patients that's most likely to work in. So one of the combinations that has been used is a combination of a drug called Strattera and ditropan, so atomoxetine and ditropan. So atomoxetine is used for children with ADHD, and ditropan is used for bladder problems. Again, I don't even know how people put these two things together and who decided that it would be a good combo. But that combo has been shown to reduce apnea. It's not, nobody really uses it routinely, mainly because there are side effects to those medications, but it is an option, and it's certainly patients who CPAP cannot use CPAP, it is certainly a combination that we need to try to see whether these are patients in which this combination would work in. A combination of things like, what am I thinking of? So cannabis also works. We know there's something in cannabis that works. It's not CBD and it's not THC. It seems to be a compound called dronabinol, which you can't get. So it's only available for research purposes. But dronabinol certainly can decrease apneas. I have a patient whose son makes cannabis pellets for him. And if he takes one of those, he's on CPAP. He has apnea. He's on CPAP. If he takes one of those cannabis pellets, he says that the pressure he needs at night for his CPAP machine drops by 2 or 3 centimeters of water, which is quite a significant drop, indicating that there is something there that works. We need to find this dronabinol. We need to do research on it, because it may be an option for people. Acetazolamide or Diamox is a compound that is used for treating altitude sickness. So it's usually what people take when they go climb up Kilimanjaro, for example. And it helps apneas. It mainly helps central apneas, but part of the process of obstructive sleep apnea is what we call ventilatory control. And that is the control in the brain of oxygen and carbon dioxide may go a little bit off and may worsen apneas. And so this particular compound in some patients has been shown to reduce the apneas. So 7 options that you have to manage apnea without using CPAP. As I mentioned, really important that you try a number of them to see which one is most likely to work for you. It may be that you need a combination of things. So you may have put on weight, so 10, 15 kilograms, but you may also recognize that there's an obstruction in your nose, for example, or you may have positional therapy, positional apnea as well. And so it is really important to look at the broad spectrum, to be aware of all 7 options, what we have to be able to treat sleep apnea with, to try a combination of these things that is more likely to work. It's very rare that we have one cause of apnea. It is much more likely that we have multiple causes. There's no question that if you're severely overweight, so you weigh 150 kilograms, that may be the only cause of apnea. It is entirely possible. But usually my experience with patients is they have a little bit of nose blockage, a little bit of reflux, 10 kilograms overweight, and it's worse when they lie on their back. And so there's a couple of things that we need to do to be able to manage the apnea. So I hope those of you who are listening who have tried single therapies have kind of go, it doesn't work, I have no other options, will relook at those single therapies because they may reduce the apnea by a little, but you may need to add something else to those therapies to get a complete result and to get the apneas down to a level which is normal, which would be below 10 apneas per hour. We wouldn't worry about less than 10 apneas per hour because you're out of the danger zone, which is over 20. So please consider the other options. Please think about them and ask doctors to help you with the other options to see if those maybe can give you some relief for the apnea. Again, if you have severe apnea, we don't have data to say that with severe apnea that any of these single options are going to resolve the apnea completely. Remember that I've spoken about they will reduce the apneas. They will, if they reduce it by 50%, if you start at an apnea level of 60 per hour, 50% is only 30, you still have severe apnea, you're going to need something else to manage that more. So I hope that was useful to you. I hope that there will be people who are listening to this podcast who will be able to say, right, I can take this into my hands. I now know what the options are. I can go and see an ear, nose, and throat surgeon. I can go and see a dentist to look at what my options are, that I have a way of monitoring it. I'm going to say again, if you do decide to do this route on your own, going to various doctors to manage all of these options, please remember at the end, you need a repeat sleep study to prove that your apneas are lower than where they are dangerous, i.e. less than 20 per hour. The lower they are, the better. But you do need to prove that point, because if you are not treated, then there's a problem and you may end up in a worse scenario, i.e. worse, more severe apnea going forward. Our data is that if you don't treat apnea, it gradually gets worse over time, so that then puts you in a situation where only CPAP is your only option. So please be careful. Please do it under medical guidance. But I hope that this gives you more avenues to explore as far as treating the apneas are concerned. Thank you, and hope you enjoyed the podcast.